Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
And welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, you could say the market's gone wild. Swings of 3 to 4% in the S&P 500 have become the norm. The Fed issued its first emergency rate cut since 2008, and 10-year Treasury yields are below 1%. What does it all mean, and when will it end?
I don't know, Sarah. Why are you asking me? How would I possibly know that?
I thought you have the answers to everything.
Anyway, of course, we'll end the episode with the craziest thing we saw in markets this week. Sarah, you know why I abstained from that competition last time?
You abstained last time because you're going to have an extra, extra great one this time.
That's right. Yeah. Well, you know, since I abstained, you know what that means. Still undefeated.
I guess that's true. That's right. We'll give it to you. I'll give it to you this time because I'm feeling nice. But
anyway, we've got some great guests that will hopefully tell us when will it end. No pressure here. But joining us for the first time on the show, very happy to have him. He is the chief macro strategist at EIA All Weather Alpha Partners, Nafal Sanala. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. And also back on the show, our old friend. He's a cross asset reporter. He's a Reddit aficionado. Luke Kawa, welcome to the show.
I'm not.
You are.
just to be clear, I am not.
You're more so than the rest of us.
Now, Luke, now that you're here, I have to tell you something, okay? You know I consider you a friend. Sarah's your friend. Even Nafal's your friend. We gathered you here to talk about that that white belt you've been wearing. The white belt, Luke.
This is an intervention, Luke.
This is an intervention.
It's
this was planned.
It's always in between Memorial Day and Labor Day somewhere.
Is he wearing it now?
Luke.
Oh, yeah.
For listeners who don't know Luke, I will describe. You actually asked how would you describe Luke's fashion sense. I describe it as risk on. he's like a levered, he's like a levered, a triple levered ETF of fashion.
You know how Luke described it? Loud.
Loud. loud and cheap was actually the full description.
So Reddit it is.
Reddit. It's hip on Reddit. Look, you know, there's appropriate times to wear a white belt. You just started karate lessons, maybe, or it's like a special occasion at the retirement home bingo night or something. Sarah's from Florida. She knows.
I know.
I'm just jealous anyway. Luke is a very progressive dresser.
Michael come in on Monday with a white belt.
I'd be happy to give Mike my belt. He just wouldn't fit it.
Oh!
Okay. Shots fired.
Okay.
Jeez, Luke. All right, you win. Anyway, Nafal, let's start with you because apart from Luke's white belt, it's just been a crazy week. I was going through one of your notes from your hedge fund that you sent around the clients, and I was astounded because you've tallied up the number of tests being done in each country for the coronavirus, and then you obviously divided it by population. Let me read the listeners some numbers here. South Korea, 2,100 approximately tests per million people. And he gives sort of a league table here. Austria, 235 per million. Goes on and on. Finland, 23 per million. Vietnam, 18. All the way at the bottom, wah, wah, wah. United States, one test per million people. And later in the note, you say, obviously, that the market is very much going to be a referendum on how well the government here is managing this crisis. I'm not getting much confidence from that one per million. Has the tide turned at all, though? Do you think they're starting to get out ahead of this? Obviously, Congress passed this $8 billion and change bill to put some money into the healthcare system and fight this. How concerned is the market that this is just not going to end up well for the U.S.?
Right. So I think, you know, before this kind of shock to the markets were kind of trying to debate whether or not this was going to be primarily kind of like a China story, a China-only story. I think as we started to see the case counts in South Korea pick up, it became clear that, no, this is not going to be kind of isolated to China. And now that we've fallen as far as we have, I do think the market now is expecting, you know, a rise in case counts as we get testing to proliferate. However, we still are quite behind the curve. So like right now, for example, the latest is that, you know, we get about 1.5 million testing capacity going forward over the next couple of weeks. However, because of the lab constraints, we can only do about 10K per day, which would take a while to scale up. So we would expect that, like, there is an inflection in case counts that's coming, but it's probably not going to be too quickly unless a private sector really steps up. And we're quite down the line on the league tables, as you mentioned. So we're pretty concerned that ultimately the markets will decide that the White House is a bit behind the curve on this threat.
I remember a couple weeks ago, there was a lot of optimism building up because there were reports coming out saying that the coronavirus was peaking. Of course, a lot of this pertained to China, but now we're seeing this international spread. And there's a lot of numbers, data flying out there regarding the coronavirus. I mean, what actually are the factors that you guys look at to try to get a sense of how this is actually progressing and to inform any investment decisions, if at all? Because it seems like it's so difficult when there's so many numbers and so much data out there that kind of flies against the face of another one.
Right. These are the type of environments that me as a macro junkie, I love, although I don't like the social implications. But the idea is that, yes, there was a sequential case count declines in China after a historic quarantine, right? Even if we wanted to, that wouldn't happen here. And it did spread, and there were community spread events across the world. And so what we're looking at is we want to see folks start to migrate from the idea of we can contain this virus, which I think is a fantasy and people are coming around to, toward how do we deal with congestion and how do we deal with capacity constraints. If you do certain social isolation procedures that prevents super high congestions in hospitals and, you know, just regular public health and in fact, public spaces in general, what that does is it slows the virus so the capacity and the healthcare infrastructure and biotechnology developments can catch up to the threat. So what we're focused on mostly is how quickly does the United States, in response to rising case counts, implement social isolation procedures that slows the virus's transmission and allows the healthcare apparatus to catch up to the threat.
If you answer your phone, it's one of your fund investors, and they say, you know, what are you guys doing? What's going on? You know, is it Nuffles not here right now? Please leave a message. Or, you know, what are you telling people? You know, what would you tell a client if they called and said, how are you guys dealing with this?
Well, if it's during market hours, then probably somebody else at our business will be handling it. But, you know, you get me on the phone outside of market hours, first thing I say, please wash your hands. It really does make a huge difference. Yeah. You know, we can debate whether masks are helpful and this and that, but like, you know, I'm sure you guys have seen what happens to the bacteria and viruses when, not just viruses, but bacteria as well. When you wash your hands for 20 seconds, it's amazing.
So what is the portfolio allocation equivalent of washing your hands?
Right. Yeah. No kidding. I like that. So, you know, we were quite bearish around Valentine's Day, as we wrote in our past note. So we were pretty well positioned going into this shock. Now what we're kind of expecting is, you know, it takes some time for the market to digest the shock. We probably have a relatively wide and volatile range for the time being. And as we start to see the potential for social isolation procedures be implemented, then it becomes, like you said, a referendum about how behind or on the curve is the White House and to what extent, you know, how long are we going to have social isolation procedures to the extent we get them? If we get them, that's the biggest risk to like earnings growth and the potential for job losses. And then the question becomes, $8.3 billion is not going to move the needle. We're going to need, you know, we need to add another zero to that. Yeah. If you look at like 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Sandy, you know, $50 to $100 billion packages. So, you know, we're nowhere near that level right now. If we see the White House and Congress suddenly catch up, perhaps, you know, the low is in. Based on the fact that President Trump called it the Corona flu Wednesday night, we do expect there's some risk for potential more downside, potentially new lows. Once we get to the point where we're starting to see kind of a little bit of panic about the effect of potential social isolation procedures, then we start bargain hunting. And then I kind of pass the baton to my partner who runs our long short portfolio.
Gotcha.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Luke, let's bring you in here. I mean, you wear that white belt, but I consider you a black belt in looking at volatility markets, right? How's that segue, Sarah?
Great segue.
That was pretty impressive.
You've really been working on these.
What's the vol market look like to you? I mean, last I looked, the VIX is kind of in that 30 range, 30, 35.
Like absolutely screaming. The volatility term structure is, is signaling a persistent degree of alarm that, I haven't seen in my few years in this business. If I was back in 2011, I probably would have seen something like this in terms of the persistence and the magnitude of how much the vol markets are saying, be very, very worried about now, but also be worried about later. That's kind of what the read and you get when the front vol month is so, the front futures contract is so high. But the second is also still so high. And one thing that's been happening is people have been getting absolutely roasted trying to short volatility. People think, when vol goes up, that means, it's a good short. And, it is true that when vol goes up, you have more kind of profit potential, more room to move just on vol coming in. But the structure of the market recently has been such that spot VIX is actually much, much, much higher than the front month. And that convergence is taking place more and more with the front month. So your actual investable way to short vol and, in an easy way, short of getting the strip, is actually converging to the upside. So people are getting pretty much absolutely killed on this. And it's a reminder that, got to look at the curve structure, got to look at the term structure when you're getting involved in this whatsoever.
Is that notion that, the market was so blatantly short volatility heading into this, is that sort of rebounding into the equity market, do you think, that maybe making these sell-offs a little bit worse?
I think somewhat. I do think there's something to the argument that the degree of euphoria we saw in January and early February has, every action has an opposite and equal reaction, just means that it's a little worse on the other side. I think all the people that were kind of flooding into single stock calls, we've seen that reverse. The equity put call actually bottomed the day the market topped at like 0.55. So many more calls trading than puts, but it hasn't really risen to kind of, alarming levels since. We're still short of like Q4 2018 put call ratios. So, that could be a sense that people are just cutting risk rather than hedging risk. But the vol metrics in terms of what people are looking for, it's crazy. Like when you think about what does a 30 VIX mean, it means essentially we're expecting a near 2% move every day for a month in the S&P 500, but that's what we're realizing. We're realizing insanely high
moves.
More than that. So I want to get your take, because with that said, so Monday we had a 4% bounce. Then on Tuesday we had this massive sell-off. Then the next day, and this was after Super Tuesday, we get another 4% bounce, and we have people out there saying, oh, it's the Biden bounce because Vice President Biden did better in Super Tuesday. Yet on Thursday we get another massive sell-off. How much can you actually look to politics at this point in time and look at the potential Democratic nominees to see who's going to run and actually make a direct correlation to market moves in a market in which it seems like we are just moving nonstop one way or the other in momentum bets every single day?
I don't think we ever had any leftism priced into the market. You know, it made sense to me, at least, that on Tuesday when the Fed cut 50 bips, that a lot of folks, including me, would come in and say, all right, this, you know, the upside catalyst has been materialized and realized. You know, we can go ahead and dump the long risk and we can short this bounce, which is what happened. Then, you know, you get that rally on Wednesday on Biden. And I think there is, you know, market practitioners tend to be a little bit right leaning. So there is a bit of a, you know, personal kind of like, you know, just feeling like a little bit more relieved. And the markets were quite volatile. So, you know, these type of moves are going to happen anyway. So that also, you know, kind of made sense to me. But that's why we were looking to fade that bounce, you know, and it's starting to work. But speaking to your point, Luke, you know, this, you know, the folks have this recency bias of, you know, buy the dip or like short the spikes in volatility. This is a very different shock than our typical shocks. This is not a shock that fiscal policy and monetary policy can by themselves handle. This is a crisis of confidence that cannot be, you know, stemmed by central bank liquidity. And it's kind of analogous to 9/11. Yeah. And so it really depends on the White House's response. And, you know, we're below Vietnam in our testing ratios. So,
yeah. And to me, the big issue is what happens in the credit markets. You know, we saw this sort of little known British airline, Flybe. I gotta say, I hadn't heard of Flybe. Had you heard of Flybe, Luke?
Never. I'm, you know, I'm a Greyhound guy, so
Greyhound's probably all right in this, I'd say. But you know, you see the credit default swaps on the cruise ship operators, Carnival and Royal Caribbean. At what point do you think the credit market really starts to freak out? I mean, it kind of is a little bit. Issuance was down. High yield issuance was sort of froze up for a few days there. Does this have the potential to become a credit crisis, do you think?
I mean, the potential is there. I don't think it will happen because I do think the pressure from the equity markets will eventually pressure a sufficient response, even if it's belated. I'm not a credit guy, so I'm not going to pretend like I am. Right. But from what I understand, it's been very difficult to trade right now. It's very illiquid. There has been a bit of a divergence between equity and credit. So I wouldn't be surprised if, for example, like one of the things we're looking for like a real bottom is a durable bottom is that, okay, we have some public health policies in place that are kind of freaking out folks about earnings trajectories and like economic commercial activity. Credit is starting to kind of, you know, spreads are starting to widen, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the hidey holes, the places where people are kind of hiding in, like, you know, tech software or like utilities, staples, those are getting hit too, reflecting, you know, just risk constraints, position liquidation. That's where we're looking for a real bottom, and we don't really quite see that yet.
So the fun credit divergence that's really crept up recently that I can comment on is, you know, I was just Thursday morning, I was running through the numbers and looking at, you know, your weekly change in the S&P 500 versus the weekly net move in investment grade credit default swaps. And, you know, normally you think stock market up, that means, you know, risk on or companies are getting more creditworthy, perceived risk of default going down. The combination of having stocks up at least, you know, 0.8 on the week, and at this point we were up, you know, 3.5% on the S&P 500, and IG CDX at least 5 basis points wider. That combination is incredibly rare. It's the last time it happened was the week ending 9/21/2018, which was literally the day after the peak in 2018, right before the route. So that's something I've been kind of keeping my eye on is credit is saying that, you know, the bounce that we've gotten in stocks should be treated as kind of, you know, the way Knopf's outlined how he's treating it.
Not your most encouraging analogy. But Knopf also pointed out some places that investors have been hiding, watching tech and the sort. Luke, you've been pointing out low volatility stocks because that was also an area that a lot of people went to hide last year. And you found that low volatility stocks have not really been living up to their name. What does that really tell you? And can you walk us through what you've actually been seeing?
Yeah, so this has been weird. And I think it's like, I think it's a combination of a high baseline volatility environment with, you know, the most defining feature we've had in the market is the relentless treasury bid that, you know, has brought yields to all-time lows, 10-year below 1, et cetera, et cetera. So what we've seen is that 10-day realized volatility in S&P 500 low volatility index actually exceeds that of the, you know, of the market at large. So this happens from time to time, but this doesn't happen during spikes. The only time this has happened, you know, in the past 5 years, during a time when, you know, realized vol is anything you could consider elevated, was in September 2016. I believe at that time we were kind of worried about lack of central bank monetary ammunition. And at that time, you know, some Trump worries seeping into the market. There was a time when investors actually thought Trump would be the worst thing ever for the market before they decided the exact opposite, you know, in the course of a night. So what we found there is essentially that the outsized movements in high vol, it seems to be a function of, and especially this was key last week when we had, you know, a correlation one sell-off, basically everything getting hit the same amount, looks, it kind of looks like your mass equity index futures selling. So what happens in bad days? Everything goes down together in a big way. But then on the up days, what are people gravitating back to? Something with an above average dividend yield and something in which the companies, their cash flow, utilities, and I believe
REITs probably.
Yeah. REITs one of them, but utilities staples. And consumer staples, yeah, staples, make up 40% of S&P 500 low vol. Yeah. That's over three times the S&P 500. Those cash streams, even in that's an environment also, of social distancing, you're still pretty reliant on
especially
those.
Especially when Lysol and Clorox
and
toilet paper is in there.
Yes. So it just strikes me as something worth monitoring, because if you I'll get out my craziest thing I've seen this week.
Oh, nice segue.
To have S&P 500 low vol beating the market on a day when the S&P 500 is up at least 4%. That's happened now four times going back to early 1972. It happened March 16th, 2000. Not a great time if you remember. October 20th, 2008. Also not a great time if you remember. And twice this week on Monday and Wednesday.
All right. Nice. I appreciate the segue, because I did not have a segue planned for once. Though we do have some voicemail. The What Goes Up hotline has been overflowing with voicemails with crazy things and other observations. Apologies that we can't play them all, but we have a couple to play. So let's hear them.
Hey, this is a message for What Goes Up. Long-time listener, first-time caller. This is your friend and colleague, Cameron Kreis. And the craziest thing I saw in markets this week was a horrible white Naga hide tie worn by Luke Kawa. Just because it seems as if markets are on trajectory to go back to 1970s levels, Luke, doesn't mean you have to dress like it. Thanks, guys.
Well,
You did set yourself up for this.
Thank you, Cameron, for that completely unsolicited.
Completely unsolicited.
Voicemail. Yeah, it's not like I said I refused to edit your column if you don't call and bust on Luke. I told him to go for the belt though, but I don't know what tie he's talking about. Do you know?
I have no idea either. All of my ties are wonderful.
He must have meant to say belt, and he just went and said tie. But
I'm just jealous, Luke. As I told Luke, Sarah, I had six older brothers. I was the youngest, and the bullying all went downhill. So I kind of look at you as that little brother I never had to the outlet for the bullying. I hope that's okay.
Looks like I can take it.
I was wondering where this was going. I was expecting it to end up in some complimentary fashion.
You're right.
But no.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you owe me money. It's just how it works. Yeah. Sarah, do you have a crazy thing you saw in the market?
I do have a crazy thing. And it'll go back to the idea of a demand for consumer staples. So I was looking around just for some different price dislocations that are caused by the coronavirus and people maybe going a little bit crazy and emergency shopping. And I went on Amazon and was looking at Purell bottles, because you can't really find Purell anywhere anymore. And I found a two-pack of 1 liter Purell bottles for $350.
It's crazy. I mean, truly the crazy. Okay, I think you won. You might have just scored your first W on that.
Did I just win? And you haven't even gone yet. And I also have one to the other side, too.
Let's hear it.
There was a pretty good story on the terminal that was laying out how flights have all of a sudden become pretty cheap because a lot of people don't want to be flying anymore. So you can get a round-trip flight from New York to Miami now for $51. So I think I'm going to have to go.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
That was literally my pick.
We can tie?
I have a backup.
Okay, good.
The problem with that $51 flight is then you got to buy a $200 bottle of Purell to sanitize everything in it.
$350.
You know, it's the hedge.
Yeah.
All right, Noff. I'll award joint winners for this one if you both had that one. But no, I'm
worries.
Glad you have a backup.
Let's do have a backup. you know, I've been just staring at the screens all day. So unfortunately, I haven't been able to check Priceline too frequently. So I guess you beat me on that one. But I think it's pretty wild. And this is more earnest than funny, that we're priced now for 25 bips for the end of the year for Fed funds.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
What that means to me is that it's very difficult now for bonds to short circuit any more stock weakness. And combine that with the quote unquote corona flu that President Trump had referred to, pretty crazy that we're at this point right now. You know, people still, I think, you know, they're defending that 3,000 level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're kind of out of firepower. I would say one thing along these lines, though. I think Chair Powell made the right move to move swiftly and forcefully because he just got the Fed out of the way.
Yeah.
And now the pressure's on the White House and Congress instead of the next 2 weeks being this long political debate about, is the Fed doing enough?
Yeah.
And so I think he made the right move. But because of that, we're at a point now where, you know, the markets, unless they're going to price in negative rates, it's up to the White House now.
Yeah.
What I'm curious. So the market's pricing 25 bips in a realistic sense where, say, the 10-year could go this year. I mean, what would you guys say?
I mean, the, you know,
yeah.
I guess
you can't make a prediction.
Paul is not here right now. Please leave a message.
Wash your hands.
My crazy thing is similar in that in the Treasury futures market, you can now buy call options on an off-the-run bond. I think it's like a maturing 2027 10-year bond that imply negative yields.
Right.
So you can now buy a call for negative yields.
Oh, yeah. And you're seeing volume in those contracts. Yeah,
especially the euro-dollar ones. Yeah. A lot of flows there.
But to just to kind of offset Mr. Cameron Kreis's anti-Luke commentary, because Luke is Canadian, I would like to say that Canadian bonds have some yield still.
That's
so we were riding long rates both in Eurodollar belly contract, mid curve contracts, as well as a long end for a while. That's less interesting to us now because again we're priced to like basically go to zero by the end of the year. So we're much more focused on the downside in equities now. But there's still some room for the Bank of Canada to catch. Well, I don't know if it's catch up or down to the Fed in this case. But
say down?
In it's terms down. Of rates, is down.
But, Luke's going to be taking that Greyhound up to Toronto to get some clip some coupons, I think, right?
I do also have to say that I believe Luke wasn't the only one who took some heat this week on the Bloomberg podcast hotline.
Uh-oh.
I'm pretty sure Mike took some heat as well.
Hi, this is Paul Meyer from Northern California, and I'm talking about what goes up. And I'm disappointed that recently we haven't gotten any obscure classic rock references, not since, I think, James Gang, Funk 49. So, come on, Mike, give us something.
Man,
Mike, give us something.
That one hurts. That I feel that one because, as we all know, obscure classic rock references are an integral part of financial journalism. I feel like I've been letting the readers and listeners down.
And you might ask yourself, how did I get here?
Not bad.
Where's my beautiful 2% treasury yield?
This kid's got a future. All right, I'll give you one classic rock reference. You know, everyone's talking about what song they sing when they wash their hands. People saying,
to make sure it gets 20 birthday. Seconds.
I'm singing the Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. That's how long I'm washing for. I'm not taking any chances, all right? So there you go.
No chances taken. And as a reminder, you can give us a call at our Bloomberg Podcast hotline. Leave us a message, and we might play it on the show. And that number is 646-324-3490. And with that said, Nawful, Luke, thanks so much for joining the show this week.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reaganonymous. Luke Kawa is at LJ Kawa. And Nawful Sanaullah is at Nawful Sanaullah. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.